Testament, and there were three P's: present, promised, and patterned. Present simply means he's there in the things that happen in the Old Testament, in the stories, he is there. Promised means promises about Jesus are made in the Old Testament to be fulfilled in the future. And patterned means the things that happen in the Old Testament are saying something by their pattern. They're saying something about Jesus through the pattern of what happens. And so today it's Jesus the sacrifice. So Jesus died on a cross as a sacrifice. There's a lot about that in the Bible, and most of it's in the Old Testament. So there's a huge feast of rich and juicy promises and patterns all about Jesus the sacrifice. And we're only going to be able to sample a few bits from that feast this morning. So we'll just catch up with the story so far. First book of the Bible is Genesis, and it starts with Adam and Eve in a perfect relationship with God, but they break their relationship with God, which is what we call sin. And the Lord makes a promise that there will be a snake crusher, a descendant of Eve, who would destroy all evil. So the fairy tale ending is promised. And the rest of the book of Genesis focuses on the family through which the snake crusher is promised to come. So the focus narrows down on a certain descendant of Eve called Abraham and his family. And God makes promises to Abraham, which are very important promises. And looking at the Bible as a whole, they take those snake crusher promises and they sort of supercharge them and expand them. And God promises to Abraham to make him a great nation, and he promises to bless all nations through his offspring. And against all odds, and against what we would say is medically possible, Abraham and his wife Sarah have a child, Isaac. And Isaac is the one through whom those promises continue. And that brings us to what I want to look at today, which is the last recorded sort of major incident in Abraham's life, and it's the sacrifice of Isaac. So as you just heard, God tells Abraham to take his son to a mountain and to sacrifice him there. And Abraham does what God says. And as Abraham takes the knife to kill his son, at the last second, he's stopped by God. What on earth is that about? I think there's quite a few different questions raised by this story, but I just want to focus on the main thing that the author wants us to know, which is the main lesson which Abraham learned. And it's clear what the main lesson Abraham learned is because of what he does afterwards, which he names the place where it happened, the Lord will provide. So verse 14 says, so Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. So Abraham must really have wanted to remember that lesson, and he must really have wanted everyone else to know that lesson, and that's why he named the place, and it worked. Because it generated a saying. So the rest of verse 14 says, and to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. What will be provided? Well, we get that from the story in verse 7 and 8. They're on the way to the mountain, and Isaac says, the fire and wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham answers, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. So God himself will provide the sacrifice. And that's what happens in this story. God stops Abraham from killing Isaac, and he provides a ram caught in a bush nearby. So Abraham goes away with this lesson. The Lord will provide the sacrifice. That's the conclusion. And there's a pattern in terms of our P's. There's a P for a pattern. And it's also sort of a promise. The Lord will provide a sacrifice. So I think we need to think about how fundamental this is to the idea of sacrifice. One view of sacrifice is that you give up something to a god in exchange for them giving you something. So you might make sacrifices, say, to the ancient Greek gods like Zeus and the others. There you would give something to the god and you would hope for something in return. Maybe good weather if you're a farmer, maybe fertility if you're struggling to conceive, maybe success in battle. So you're giving something to try and put a god in your debt or to try and pay off a debt. So it's sort of, here you go, Zeus, please look kindly on me. But the story we've just read gives a fundamentally different type of sacrifice. The Lord will provide the sacrifice. So with the God of Abraham, it can't be about giving something to him to put him in your debt, because the Lord will provide the sacrifice. So it turns it on its head, doesn't it? And we see that the other approach is actually a perversion of the true sacrifice. The other approach, like with the Greek gods, like with all sacrifices to all of the gods, secular and religious, they demand something from you. But with the Jesus God, the God of Abraham, he provides the sacrifice. And so, of course, we clearly see how this pattern comes to fulfillment in Jesus' death on a cross. The Lord will provide the sacrifice, and on a hill outside Jerusalem, thousands of years after Abraham, the Lord provided the ultimate sacrifice himself. So we can look back to Jesus, just as Abraham looked forward, we can look back and say, the Lord has provided the sacrifice. So the focus of Christianity is not what we give to God, but what he has given to us. Think about communion. We come to the communion table to receive the bread and the wine, Jesus' body and blood. We don't come to make promises to God about how much we're going to sacrifice to him. We come to receive, to remember Jesus providing his body, his very life to us. But why was a sacrifice needed at all? Why does the Lord need to provide a sacrifice? To start to answer that question, I'm going to carry on in the story, carry on in the Bible now, up to the start of Leviticus, which is where God gave his people a detailed system of sacrifices. But remember what Abraham called that place where Isaac was not sacrificed. We'll need that later on. So after not being sacrificed, Isaac lived on and he had children. The promise of the snake crusher and the promise of the blessing carried on through Abraham, through Isaac, and then to Isaac's son Jacob, who was later called Israel. And Israel had 12 sons whose families became the 12 tribes of Israel. One of those 12 was Joseph. That's Joseph, famous for his technical dream coat. And through a series of incredible events, the whole family end up in Egypt, with Joseph second in command of the country beneath Pharaoh. It's then that the Israelites start to grow in number over hundreds of years living in Egypt. But in time, they also become slaves to the Egyptians. God sends an Israelite called Moses to lead his people out of Egypt. God rescues his people through Moses, and that rescue is called the Exodus. And that's the name we give to the second book of the Bible. The Israelites escape from Egypt, and they come to a mountain called Mount Sinai, where God gives them the law through Moses. So the second half of the book of Exodus, first half is about the rescue, the second half takes place at Mount Sinai. God gives them laws, like the Ten Commandments, for example, and he also gives them detailed instructions to build something called the tabernacle. And the tabernacle is so that God can come and live with them. And it's a really important, exciting time because God has not lived with his people since Adam and Eve. But there's a tension in the book of Exodus because of this. When God comes close to his people, there's a problem. The problem is that God is not like his people. God is holy and his people are not. Holy does mean morally perfect, but it means a lot more than that. I've heard it described as being like the sun. The sun is unique, powerful, and the source of life, at least in our solar system. The sun is holy in a way, and in fact, the whole area around the sun is holy. You can't get too close because you'll burn up. The very power and goodness that's the source of life is also dangerous. And God is like that. If you're not pure, if you're not holy, then his presence is extremely dangerous to you. And not because he's bad, but because he's so good. He passionately hates anything unholy, anything evil, anything not good. So at the end of Exodus, Moses and the people finish building the tabernacle in line with the instructions, and God comes down into the tabernacle. And Moses and all the people are driven out. They can't come near because they're not holy and God is mega holy. So there's separation from God. And the tabernacle itself is actually a pattern which shows this separation. So the tabernacle would have looked something like that. It's an area surrounded with tent-like walls and there's another inner tent. And this sort of plan view shows you that the inner tent was divided in two. And the tabernacle is really a model of all reality. That's what it is. It's supposed to tell you something about ultimate reality through how it's set out. And one of the most striking things is that red line, which is a thick curtain which separates the most holy place, where God is, from everywhere else. So that curtain is saying, you can't come in here. There's a barrier. There's a barrier between you and God. And it's just like the barrier of fire that surrounded the Garden of Eden, so Adam and Eve couldn't get back in. And that fire is God's anger at our sin, at everything unholy. So at the end of Exodus, they finish building the tabernacle, as I said. They're driven out, and it's like they've come too close to the sun. And then the book of Leviticus starts immediately, and God calls or shouts to Moses from the tabernacle, and he shouts for seven chapters, instructions, and it's like God saying, yes, there's a barrier between us, there's separation, and you can't come near, but I'm going to solve the problem. Here's what you've got to do. And he describes five offerings, five sacrifices that represent God's way to sort out the separation between us and him, to get through the veil or through the fire. And these are the five sacrifices. And they're sacrifices to reconcile people to God. And I'm going to summarize each of the five sacrifices or steps, if you like. It might be helpful to think about them in terms of reconciling people to each other first. So if you imagine someone committed some really serious crime against you, I mean a really serious damaging crime, what would it take to be reconciled to that person who'd wronged you? Not just to overlook the wrong, not just even to forgive it, but to completely overcome it, fully clean it up, fully deal with it, fully reconciled and be fully at peace with that person so that you could even be friends with them. And you might say that's not possible. Some things are too serious and damaging, and you can never be friends with that person. And I would sort of agree with you, but imagine it was possible. What steps would you have to go through? Well, these are the five steps corresponding to the offerings. So step one, the wrong would need to be taken seriously and punished. You can't be fully reconciled to someone if they don't take it seriously and they laugh it off as if it was nothing. It would need to be identified. It would need to be owned up to and taken as seriously wrong. And it would also need to be punished. There needs to be a reckoning. And this is the burnt offering, which we had read, the description of which we had read to us. So the person making the offering brings an animal. They place their hand on the animal's head to symbolize the animal taking their place. And then they kill it and burn it. And it's like the animal goes into the fire of the Lord's anger rather than the person. So the wrong is taken seriously and punishment is dealt, although it falls on the animal instead of the person. So step two, there'd need to be a total change of behaviour so that the wrong was never repeated. So you can't be fully at peace with someone who seriously wronged you if you fear they're going to do it again. And this is represented by the grain offering, where grain is offered, being like the first and best of the harvest. It's like a perfect and pure life being offered. Step three, the stain of the evil would need to be washed away. And by stain, I mean the shame, the corruption, the pollution, the legacy left by evil. You might think, if, for example, if someone's broken into your house, the first thing that might bother you is the feeling that your house is unclean. You might worry about the property that was stolen later, but first you might be struck that a stranger came into your home without your permission and did whatever they wanted. Your home feels defiled. Or you might think of Lady Macbeth constantly trying to wash blood off her hands. And the washing away of the effects of evil is represented by the sin offering. So step four, the loss or damage would need to be repaid. Evil and wrongdoing causes loss, doesn't it? And that would need to be put right if the wrongdoing is to be completely overcome. So it might be loss of money or property, but it could be many other things. Loss of life, loss of family or friends, loss of health, loss of innocence, loss of security. Those things, we probably can't imagine how they'd be repaid. But they would need to be repaid if we're talking about fully overcoming the wrong. And that's represented by the guilt offering. And then finally, if the first four steps have been completed, if the wrong has been taken seriously and punished, there's been a total change of behaviour, the effects of the wrong have been washed away and the damage is repaid, then the final step would be to sit down and have a meal together to bring about that reconciliation and friendship. If the other steps have taken place, then this final step five is possible. This is represented by the peace offering. And it's the only offering where the priest could cook and eat the animals and the bread that was brought, and they have a meal, and they could make a couple of days out of it if they wanted. So those are the steps to completely wash away a serious wrong. But how can we go through those steps? We might be able to do some of them, but some are difficult or we have no chance. Think about step four, the loss or damage must be repaid. I've already said that we might be able to repay money or property, but how to repay other things like health or innocence? We can't really do that. And step two, a total change of behaviour. When we wrong someone, can we promise never to do it again? We can only promise to try, really, can't we? Problem is worse than that, though. I mentioned the steps, or the offerings, were primarily about reconciling between God and people. So how do we go through the five steps to deal with being cut off from God? We fall at step one. Even if we could take it seriously enough, how would we bear God's punishment? It would destroy us. I've already said we can't offer a change of behaviour. That's step two. How do we wash away the corrupting effects of our sin? Which is step three. The only way would be to wash away everything and start again. Step four is repaying damages. I mean, how can we repay God? Do you remember what Abraham called that place? What was the lesson from the sacrifice of Isaac? The Lord will provide the sacrifice. The Lord has provided the sacrifice himself, Jesus. The offerings were just a temporary solution, those five offerings. They never really dealt with the separation between God and his people. They are a pattern. Five offerings spoke to God's people at the time of Moses, and they've been speaking ever since, including to us today. They speak of the problem. They also speak of Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection. So Jesus is the burnt offering. He takes the punishment required through his death on the cross. He is destroyed rather than us. Jesus lived a perfect life as a human, so is the perfect grain offering. The perfect life is provided for us. The Lord has provided the sacrifice. Jesus' blood can clean away the effects of our evil. That's the sin offering. Jesus started a new creation that's not yet complete. It's in the future, but everything will be put right in that new creation. Everything will be repaid. That's the guilt offering. And you might know when Jesus died, the curtain in the tabernacle was torn in two. That's the curtain we were talking about earlier. It was torn in two, representing the separation between God and us coming to an end. And so finally, through Jesus' perfect sacrifice, we can share in that perfectly restored relationship with God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Lord has provided the sacrifice. So stop trying to offer other things to God. If you're a Christian, your relationship with God is restored. So stop trying to restore it yourself. Stop trying to think if you try very hard to be a better person, you'll get closer to God. You're not any closer to God on your good days than you are on your bad days. Stop trying to offer things to God to restore the relationship. You have nothing to offer. Your prayers, your good works, your money, your time, they're all worth nothing without Jesus. But Jesus, the sacrifice, has already been offered. You're already close to God. You're already through the curtain. You can't get any closer. You're in the inner circle, and I don't just mean you're a trusted servant or just a close friend. You're a loved child. and it's based on Jesus' death and Jesus' life. And if you're not a Christian, you're cut off from God. You're on the wrong side of the curtain. You're cut off from the holy God, the unique, powerful source of life. So you're heading towards death, but with no hope. Accept Jesus. Accept his sacrifice, his body and blood given for you. Accept that he sacrificed himself for you. The Lord has provided the sacrifice.